Today, the United States is designating North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism.
The United States reinstates that designation. The wait is on for any reaction from Pyongyang. It's Tuesday, November 21st, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of the program. Join us at any of our VOA Asia social media platforms. Also ahead, is it possible that China had a role in an attempt to oust a longtime African leader? We'll have that conversation. And a U.S. Marine is being held by Japanese authorities on suspicion of negligence in driving while intoxicated in the death of a Japanese driver. All of that and more on today's VOA Asia. The United States will redesignate North Korea a state sponsor of terrorism. That's a move meant to put additional financial and diplomatic pressure on the totalitarian government. President Donald Trump made the announcement of the redesignation Monday at the White House.
Today, the United States is designating North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. Should have happened a long time ago, should have happened years ago. In addition to threatening the world by nuclear devastation, North Korea has repeatedly supported acts of international terrorism, including assassinations on foreign soil. As we take this action today, our thoughts turn to Otto Warmbier, wonderful young man, and the countless others so brutally affected by the North Korean oppression. This designation will impose further sanctions and penalties on North Korea and related persons and supports our maximum pressure campaign to isolate the murderous regime that you've all been reading about and in some cases writing about. Tomorrow, the Treasury Department will be announcing an additional sanction and a very large one on North Korea, and this will be going on over the next 2 weeks. It'll be the highest level of sanctions by the time it's finished over a two-week period. The North Korean regime must be lawful. It must end its unlawful nuclear and ballistic missile development and cease all support for international terrorism, which it is not doing.
This redesignation will be formally announced Tuesday by the State Department. The only countries on that State Department sponsors of terrorism list now are Iran, Syria, and Sudan. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson later on Monday told reporters about the process that was involved in again putting North Korea on that list.
There is a very specific designation process that we have to go through at the State Department to be able to meet the criteria to make such a designation, and we wanted to ensure we had fully met all those requirements. Again, this is all part of just continuing to turn this pressure up, and we continue to turn the pressure up on North Korea by getting other countries to join and take actions on their own. We've had other countries in our visit to Vietnam, they have committed that they're going to curtail activities further with North Korea. Malaysia has indicated a curtailment. Singapore has cut off all trade with North Korea. The Philippines have cut off all trade. And just recently, the Deputy Secretary of State's been in Africa. He had meetings with the Sudanese government. The Sudanese government have traditionally been buying military weapons from North Korea. They now have agreed to halt all those purchases as well. So this is it's taking effect all around the world. And we think as it takes effect, again, this just continues to tighten the pressure on the Kim regime, all with an intention to have him understand this is only going to get worse until you're ready to come and talk.
The top U.S. diplomat added that sanctions already in progress are playing a part in hurting the DPRK economy.
I think the general belief is it is having a significant effect on North Korea. We know that there are current shortages of fuel based upon what we can gather from anecdotally, but also from certain intel sources. We know that that their revenues are down because a number of the revenue streams are being curtailed now. So I think it is having an effect. Is this the reason we haven't had a provocative act in 60 days? I don't want to suggest to you that I could say, but we're hopeful this period will continue. And again, I think the president in his address in Seoul, South Korea, to the General Assembly, I thought he laid out the case very well to them that he wanted them to come have talks because he wants to deliver a different future to the people of North Korea.
The U.S. put North Korea on this list in 1988 after North Korean agents blew up a South Korean civilian airliner, killing 115 people. However, Pyongyang was removed in 2008 after meeting benchmarks related to a nuclear disarmament deal. The six-party disarmament talks collapsed a short time later, and North Korea declared the nuclear deal void. It has since conducted five nuclear tests and ramped up its ballistic missile program in violation of UN resolutions. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. The U.S. is to relist North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. Japanese officials lodge a strong protest over a vehicle accident caused by a drunken U.S. Marine that resulted in the death of a Japanese motorist. The U.S. hits Taliban drug labs in Afghanistan under a new strategy. Indonesia's anti-graft agency detains that country's House Speaker. And the Cambodian leader tells us the U.S. should cut all aid to his country. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. One of the top international stories this day comes from the African nation of Zimbabwe, where that country's longtime president, Robert Mugabe, has ignored a Monday noon deadline to either step down or face impeachment. Mugabe made clear in a televised speech Sunday that he did not intend to resign. There are reports circulating that China might have been involved in the decision to take Mugabe out of office. We welcome to VOA Asia Yun Sun, senior associate of the East Asia Program at the Washington-based Stinson Center. Her expertise is in China foreign policy, and the background noise you will hear is because she is waiting for a flight at the airport. Yun, thanks so much for being with us. First of all, do you believe those reports of Chinese involvement? And if you do, can you explain what might have occurred here?
Well, the timing is really intriguing because the military leader of Zimbabwe visited China a few days before the coup in Zimbabwe, before the political turmoil started. So it automatically raises the question that when he was in Beijing and when he was meeting with Chinese military leaders and political leaders, what message did the Zimbabwe military leader convey to the Chinese? We know that China and Zimbabwe have had long-standing political and economic ties, and China has developed concerns about Zimbabwe's domestic policy, given the instability and the economic chaos that the Mugabe government has created inside his country. So I don't believe that China was explicitly discussing the political plan, the coup plan of the military leaders of Zimbabwe when he was in Beijing, because that would put China in a very vulnerable position, and it will put China's foreign policy principle of non-interference under dramatic scrutiny and challenge internationally. And that's not in China's interest. It also doesn't give China the deniability of any involvement in case this political coup does not succeed. So I believe that China does have concern about Mugabe's policy, and China has lobbied for Mugabe to change his policy. However, for China to be actively involved or support of a coup, I think that goes too far.
Well, has China said anything dealing with this whatsoever?
After the political turmoil started, the Chinese position is we want Zimbabwe to be peaceful and to be stable. We don't support a civil war. And we look forward to work with the Zimbabwe government regardless of who the leader will be.
Now, China has become a major trading partner with Zimbabwe. What do you think has happened? Why has the tenure of Mugabe come to a point or reached a point where China might not be happy with it?
Well, it's primarily because of the economic policy of the Mugabe government. China's interest in Zimbabwe has been one on trade, like you pointed out. The other one is Chinese investment in the natural resources sectors inside Zimbabwe. But we also know that Mugabe has gone back and forth on the issue of naturalization of foreign investment and also indigenization of foreign projects. For example, the diamond mines that the Chinese have invested in was going to be indigenized, meaning that the Zimbabwean government was going to naturalize the Chinese mines that the Chinese invested in. And that automatically raised the question that what does the political solidarity really translate into? If Mugabe was perceiving China as a foreign exploiter of his of the Zimbabwean economy, that put his policy and China's policy into direct conflict and in a collision course. So that issue has been a main sore spot between Beijing and Mugabe.
How involved is China with the local economy of Zimbabwe?
Well, given the Western sanction on Zimbabwe and given the lack of alternatives, I would say that the Chinese are pretty deeply involved in the local economy. We just talked about the natural resources sector. The export of Chinese products in Zimbabwe is also pretty significant. So Zimbabwe is one of China's largest economic partners coming to the African continent.
Sun Yun is the senior associate with the East Asia program at the Washington-based Stimson Center. Yun, thank you so much for being with us. Have yourself a good trip. Happening now in Asia, the U.S. puts North Korea back on its list of state sponsors of terrorism. An Okinawa car crash sparks an alcohol ban for U.S. troops in Japan. The North Korean foreign minister heads to Cuba. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Stay with us. A U.S. Marine is being held by Japanese authorities on suspicion of negligence and driving while intoxicated in the death of a Japanese driver Sunday on Okinawa that could spark renewed tensions over the U.S. military presence on that southern island. Japan's Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga said his government has expressed deep regret and submitted a stern representation to the U.S. military and embassy to make sure such accidents don't happen. He said provincial police in Okinawa have launched an investigation. In response, U.S. forces have banned until further notice the consumption of alcohol by all U.S. personnel in Japan. U.S. Ambassador William Haggerty expressed his condolences and offered an apology. A similar ban was imposed last year after a head-on collision involving a young military service member. No one was killed there, but it followed the case of a military contractor who pleaded guilty last week to raping a 20-year-old local woman who was found dead. He was found not guilty of murder. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, told VOA's Victor Beatty such incidents have happened for years and are a serious distraction.
And not to mention just tragic, and there is nothing good one can say about it. There is no excuse for it. One hardly knows what to say, especially as you've been around this issue for a long time. The maddening inability of U.S. forces to completely eliminate these sorts of tragic accidents is an ongoing problem. The U.S. military does its best to try to minimize it, but all that does is offer some context. But it really, as I say, these are very hard to completely eliminate, but tragic accidents.
U.S. forces have been based in Japan, of course, since the end of the Second World War. Taken all together, what does this bode for the future of U.S.-Japan military relations?
This helps to be able to step back a bit and put these into the larger context of the U.S. presence in Japan. Japan gets the services of the world's most powerful military really in exchange for really some real estate and a pittance of a financial contribution. So there is really the national security angle here, and then there is always the local basing issue, the local communities that have to have bases around them. And this really is nothing new, nor is it unique for Japan. Once again, it's not to dismiss any of this, but it is to put it in a larger context. These sorts of incidents really do need to be eliminated if possible. That may not be realistic, however, given just human nature being what it is. And also it's worth noting that in other parts of Japan, say Yokosuka up near Tokyo, Sasebo and Kyushu, and Misawa up north, where you have large U.S. Air Force base, and Yokota near Tokyo with a big Air Force base as well. But they also have similar incidents every now and then. But you have sort of a cushion there which can withstand these sorts of events and deal with them and then move on. And that's something that you don't find in Okinawa much. There really isn't this cushion. It's not to say there isn't support for the U.S. military presence, or at least tolerance of it in Okinawa by many, many Okinawans, perhaps even a majority. But you do have a vocal opposition that does make use of these sorts of incidents to put its anti-base, anti-military, really anti-Tokyo case across.
Grant Newsham said Okinawa benefits from massive Japanese government subsidies for the presence of U.S. forces and insisted the island is not a hotbed of anti-American sentiment. But he said the U.S. military has failed to keep up a community outreach program that seemed in recent years to have helped improve its image among the local population. This is VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Here's a news alert from VOA Asia. The U.S. president declares North Korea a state sponsor of terrorism. Alibaba invests in a top Chinese grocer. It cost him $2.87 billion. Singapore imposes high fees to keep cars off the roads. It's too crowded there, they say. Foreign ministers from Asia and the European Union gather in Myanmar for the 13th Asia-Europe meeting. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. The U.S. military has launched airstrikes on drug-making laboratories in Afghanistan as part of a new joint strategy with Afghan forces to cut off funding for the Taliban. General John Nicholson, commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, said 10 drug labs were destroyed in a series of aerial bombardments in the poppy-rich southern province of Helmand, a Taliban stronghold, on Sunday night.
Our combined operations over the last 24 hours are a demonstration of our will to defeat terrorists and those who support them, especially in the narcotics networks. The release of the UN's Office of Drug and Crime report last week underscores the threat of narcotics in Afghanistan, and together we are addressing this threat. The strikes that were prosecuted last night will continue. And the neighbors, the other external actors who meddle in Afghanistan for their own gain, must also realize that they have picked the wrong side, the side of terrorists and criminals who harm all people, not just the Afghan people, but people in their own countries as well. This took weeks of preparation, and based on the new authorities that I've received in the last 90 days with the U.S. policy announcement, we started developing targets immediately. We took every precaution to ensure that we struck the highest payoff targets with great precision.
Nicholson said targeting the drug labs would hit the Taliban where it hurts and warned of more strikes to follow. He said, "We hit the labs where they turned poppy into heroin. We hit their storage facilities where they kept their final products, where they stockpiled their money and their command and control." He noted that 400 or 500 drug labs active are across the country. The Taliban profits from the illegal drug trade by taxing poppy farmers and traffickers across the war-torn country, pocketing an estimated $200 million a year, according to official data. It was the first time an American F-22 stealth fighter had conducted an airstrike in Afghanistan, and Nicholson noted that the U.S. Air Force now has more air power at its disposal as operations against the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria taper down. Taliban issued a statement denying the existence of the drug-making facilities. The U.S.-Afghanistan operation comes around 3,000 additional American troops promised by President Trump are deployed to help train and assist beleaguered Afghan security forces who have been struggling to beat back Taliban and Islamic State insurgents. The U.N. Office on Drugs and Crime warned last week that the significant levels of opium cultivation and trafficking in Afghanistan would fuel the insurgency and boost funding for militants. The area under poppy cultivation has expanded by 63% to a record of 328,000 hectares this year, topping the previous record of 224,000 hectares in 2014, with the number of poppy-growing provinces jumping to 24. Only 10 Afghan provinces are now considered to be poppy-free. Nicholson said the Taliban had evolved into a narco-insurgency fighting to protect earnings from drug trafficking, illegal mining, kidnapping, and murder for hire. This news alert from VOA Asia, the UN says North Korean women suffer discrimination, rape, and malnutrition. The United States puts North Korea back on its list of countries supporting terrorism. The renowned lingerie company Victoria's Secret hosts its first ever fashion show in China. All the big stories coming your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. While the Afghan military, with the help of NATO forces, is carrying out an operation to clear eastern Afghanistan of the militant Islamic State group, the day-to-day security of the area is now in the hands of a controversial local police force funded by the United States. VOA's Aisha Tanzim spent time with the Afghan local police in the Achin district of eastern Afghanistan, where this force is primarily fighting the Islamic State militants.
With their long hair and irregular fatigues, these men may look like militants, but they're villagers who work for the Afghan local police. In the Achin district of eastern Afghanistan, they often form the first line of defense if the Islamic State attacks a local village. This force is so effective because their families have been some of the first victims of the brutality of IS in Achin. They're not just fighting for money, they're fighting to protect their land and their loved ones. ALP started with help from the United States in 2010. The idea was to give locals a stake in their own security, particularly in areas where the government's security presence was weak.
We've picked up these guns to protect our women and children. We are not doing this for money or for a salary. The $100 or $150 we get per month is nothing. We can earn that doing anything else.
Today, the force operates in 31 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces and has become an important part of Afghanistan's security strategy. But while locals in Achin seem to be happy with their ALP unit, in many parts of Afghanistan, it has faced accusations of human rights violations, abuse of power, and becoming a tool for the local strongmen. Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission says recruitment in the ALP is not always done according to protocol. Criminals, members of illegal armed groups, even the Taliban in some cases have managed to join the local force. The U.S. has made future funding for the force conditional on reforms. The Afghan government has taken some action, but human rights groups say much more is needed. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Achin, Nangarhar Province, Afghanistan.
The most famous names of the modeling industry descended upon the Victoria's Secret fashion show in Shanghai Monday amid controversy over visa issues and tightening publicity rules. In Goddess, Victoria's Secret Angel strutted massive floor-sweeping silk wings with gold and silver sequin lingerie and, of course, plenty of bling. Absent from the show were supermodel Gigi Hadid, Bella's sister, and singer Katy Perry. Both were slated to take part, but announced their absences only days before. Gigi Hadid said on her Twitter account she'd not be walking in the show a few months after Chinese internet users accused her of racist behavior. You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. You can find us at voanews.com. Let's hear from you, VOA Asia Facebook, and our email at voaasia@voaasia.com. Thanks for joining us. Our thanks to Tracy Carter, our director, Jim Clark, our engineer, our managing editor, Diane Gal, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, David Bird, and Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great day.